When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This is the Project Upland Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt. On this episode of the show, we've got one of our regulars back. We're talking bird dogs and double guns with Greg Elliott of dogsanddoubles.com. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 134. Project Upland Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Use the promo code PUP20 to save 20% on your subscription to Onyx Hunt. Download the Hunt app from the iTunes or Google Play Store today. Know where you stand with Onyx. And by Eukanuba Premium Performance Dog Food. If you want to get the most out of your dog, you need nutrition that holds nothing back. To help unleash your dog's maximum potential, check out the new Eukanuba Premium Performance lineup at EukanubaSportingDog.com. And by CZ USA. Shotguns designed with the upland hunter in mind, from the Bob White Sharptail Side-by-Sides to the Wing Shooter Elite and Upland Ultralight Over and Unders, and the soon-to-be Project Upland CZ USA crowdsourced shotgun debuting very soon. CZ USA, they've got pumps, they've got semi-autos. CZ USA has a shotgun for you. Learn more and find your next bird hunting gun at cz-usa.com. And by Electronic Shooters Protection. Custom molded, custom fit hearing protection lets you hear everything that you want to hear and blocks out everything that you don't. Learn more and get yourself a pair at espamerica.com. And by Sage and Breaker. Makers of gun cleaning products that protect legacies, the legacy of your firearm, the legacy of the sport, and the legacy of passing both down to future generations, Sage & Breaker lives, breathes, and makes everything at the highest caliber possible, and they are proud to pass that caliber of craftsmanship on to you. Learn more at sageandbreaker.com. And by Dakota 283 Kennels, unparalleled protection, one-piece rotomold design, frame steel door, everything you and your dog need in a kennel for a safe and successful hunting trip. And just released this week, our latest film, which takes you to South Dakota to Greg Cronkite's farm as he shares with us the story of Dakota 283. Head over to projectupland.com, check that out, and find your next kennel at dakota283.com. All right, this week's winner of the podcast giveaway, Josh G. from Canada. Josh left us a review for the podcast. He also sent me an email and told me about some of his bird hunting adventures. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate it. Project Upland t-shirt headed your way very soon. Anybody listening could be next week's winner of the podcast giveaway. All you have to do is make a meaningful contribution to the show. You can leave us a rating or a review in your podcast app. You can subscribe to the podcast, share the podcast, send us some feedback or a guest suggestion or a bird hunting story. I'd love to hear from my listeners. You can email me at nick.larson@northwoodscollective.com. All right, it's still February, and with that comes another reminder for a limited time sale. One of our partners on the podcast, Gumleaf USA. If you're in the market for rubber boots, head over to gumleafusa.com. Check out their selection of in-stock boots, and you can use the promo code Hartley, that's H-A-R-T-L-E-Y, promo code Hartley to save 25% on any pair of boots in stock from GumleafUSA.com through the end of February. Go check them out before they're gone. GumleafUSA.com. And that brings us to our episode today. A former repeat guest of the podcast, one of my favorite people to speak with, especially this time of year, my mind inevitably turns to shotguns. And when it comes to shotguns, Greg Elliott is a wealth of knowledge. For that reason, we welcomed him back to the Project Upland podcast to dive a little bit deeper into the world of shotguns, catch up on what Greg has been up to, talked about a little bit about his bird dogs, and then we transition into our conversation about shotguns. With that said, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Project Upland podcast of dogsanddoubles.com, Greg Elliott. I'm ready to go, Greg.
All right, cool.
I'm ready to go.
Let me put you here so it's not too weird. It's strange to talk and not see the person you're talking to, so I have to get
my laptop
in the right place.
So. I like the artwork behind you there.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Field and Stream covers, rough grouse stuff.
Yeah, grouse, race cars, all sorts of stuff.
Perfect. Welcome back to the Project Upland podcast, man.
Hey,
Greg
thanks.
Elliott of Dogs and Doubles. How are you?
Good. I'm doing great. Doing great. Good to be back.
Yeah.
How long you guys been doing this podcast now?
Since September of 2017. So
wow.
We are well into year, I guess it'll be 4 years this fall, so we're in year three.
Wow.
Pretty crazy. Yep, it's I don't recall exactly the last time we had you on, probably a couple years ago. We had you on early, we did a two-part episode, and then I brought you back another time to talk about the Fox guns, and now it's been a while.
Yeah, well, we did the Greeny thing.
Oh, you're right, and that's why I was going to get to that, because it was roughly a year ago, the last time I saw you, we were down in Texas, and yeah, we did the podcast with Caesar Greeny, but
yeah.
I'm sure that it feels this way to you. Everything that happened about a year ago feels like it was 10 years ago, just because of everything that happened last year. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was almost like, so it was the weekend of the Super Bowl last year.
Yes, yep, we watched the Super Bowl in Texas. How long ago does that truly feel?
Yeah.
Well, what have you been up to, man? What's been keeping you busy?
So the same old stuff, you know, so doing the Dogs and Doubles, so writing the blog, you know, on Instagram, everything under Dogs and Doubles. I've been, you know, wrote some stuff for Project Upland magazine. I think I had some articles in Shooting Sportsman in 2020. What else? You know, chasing guns. And so I was last year, you know, I was working my dogs, getting ready for the fall, you know, getting ready for the hunting season. And then after the hunting season, I lost both my dogs, had to put them both down. So, yeah, that was sort of the big shocking thing that happened in 2020. But other than that, everything else was kind of what I always do, you know, look for guns, train my dogs, look for places to go hunting. So,
and write about guns.
Yeah, and write about everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, man, well, you brought it up, and certainly I follow you on Instagram, and we keep in touch, and we talked about a week ago, and obviously, you had to do the hardest thing a bird dog owner has to do, and you lost two dogs, and it was sooner than you should have lost them, too. So I obviously can't imagine what that would have been like at the end of 2020, of all things. I mean, unbelievable, man.
Yeah, it was really brutal. Yeah, the first one, so Lexi, my older one, who was 6.5, she had cancer, and she hunted. So I hunted the last 2 weeks of October. I hunted those full 2 weeks, and she hunted a lot. And pretty much right up until the last day, she was fine. You know, she was showing signs of being tired, but, you know, but I had hunted her quite a bit. So I just assumed that she was just tired from hunting. She hunted really well the last day. The last day was November 1st. And then on November 14th, and then I got her home and she wasn't eating well and she was definitely lethargic and she started losing weight. And then on November 14th, she was doing really poorly. I brought her into the vet. She was diagnosed with cancer on the 14th, and then on the 18th, we had to put her down. So she went downhill, you know, within basically 2.5 weeks. She went from hunting and not showing any signs of being sick to, you know, having to be let go. So that was pretty shocking. And then the other one had an issue, and about a month later, and so she was 4.5. Oh, she was almost 5. Yeah, so it was pretty rough. You know, those were my hunting dogs, and I, you know, had them since they were pups, and you know, they were both. Lexi was really well trained. You know, she had won field trials and stuff. She'd done really well. So,
about the worst thing that could happen, man. I don't mean to drag you through it. I don't know if it helps or hurts to talk about it or anything, but I certainly didn't want to didn't want to ignore it. And
no, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, it's brutal. Yeah, I mean, especially when it's not it's unexpected. Now, if the dog's,
right.
I had another dog that I had put down, but she was like 11 and a half. So, and when they're older, it's easier. I mean, it's still, she had cancer, and it was still unexpected. But when they're younger, it's just, especially Lexi was in her prime, and she hunted extremely well throughout October, and But the good news is we have a puppy, another puppy coming next week, so we'll get back in and start all over again. So.
Yeah. Tell me about the new pup a little bit.
Yeah. So another pointer. This one's coming from a breeder in Oklahoma. My other dogs are from a breeder in Wisconsin. But they're still – my other ones were very Elihu, what you call Elihu bred pointers, very Elihu.
Okay.
This one that's coming – is a little, she's probably more like 80% Elihu, 75. So she's a little less Elihu, and she'll probably be what I call a little hotter dog. So she'll probably be run a little bit more in the woods, maybe a little further. So she's got some of the blood she's got in her is a little more like all age field trial dog. So she'll be a little hotter, but not too much. But other than that, she's still a lot like, she'll be like a, what I call like a cover dog English pointer, you know, a little smaller. They're not as big as the all age dogs.
Okay.
But yeah, she's coming from Oklahoma. She's the person that's bringing her to us is the dog's in the car right now. They're driving her out. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is she arriving this weekend?
She's arriving next week. So they picked her up
next week.
She's in the dog is in Oklahoma. They picked her up yesterday. No, they picked her up on the 10th. Yeah, today's Friday, right? Yeah. It's
a couple days ago. Yep.
Yeah, they picked her up on the 10th. And the weather has been really bad out there. And so they've been held up. And so they're driving. It's what's called a dog hauling service. And
Tell us about this. Yeah. But for the listeners, it's interesting.
Yeah, so there's this woman who has, I think it's the company's called Buckeye Dog Haulers. And they basically transport dogs around. Around the eastern half of the United States, basically. I mean, they have a couple different drivers. I mean, this is what I've been able to figure out from sort of talking to them. They have a couple different drivers who go out and pick up dogs, and then they have like a centralized hub that people bring the dog, that these, some drivers bring the dogs to the hubs, and then other drivers deliver them to other places. Anyway, our dog's supposed to be here Tuesday and next week. So this dog's going to go from Oklahoma to Boston. They're going to drive it out. This time of year, flying a dog is hard to do because it's so cold.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the airlines won't do it
because
it's too cold.
Right? Yeah.
And then the other thing with COVID and all that stuff going on, it's just, I didn't want to deal with airports.
Yeah.
And it was too far for me to drive out and get her. So, the dog hauling thing is a great option. I know we talked about this before. These people also do is they do a lot of picking up puppies and transporting dogs to new owners. But they also, like, if... They also move dogs around for guys that are looking to go places and go hunting. So they will, like, so if you want to go hunting in Oklahoma, you could have these people pick your dog up, transport it out to some place where you're going where they can drop it off, and then you could fly out, hunt, and then have them pick the dog back up and bring it back. You know, you want to do something like that with an older dog that's more, you know, used to traveling and stuff. But people do that. I know guys that do that. I know people who have dogs. You know, they want to go hunting out west for a week, but they don't want to spend 4 or 5 days driving. They can, or they have one guy that's going to go out and he's going to bring all the gear and they're going to meet him and something like that. But these dog haulers just make it a lot easier to move your dog around. And the people I talked to about this, this place, Buckeye, said that they were, you know, really reputable and trustworthy and they took really good care of the dog. So they sent me pictures of our new puppy on the road, and so she looks like she's having a good time. So,
what's the? Did they tell you like what's the transport situation? She's in a crate.
She's in the crate. It looks like she's in the back of like a caravan. You know, like a minivan.
Yeah. Climate controlled.
Yeah. So she's in a confined. She's in a space that has climate control. She's not like in a dog box in the back of a pickup truck.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Especially with a puppy, that's really, you know, taking a puppy and throwing it in a dog box by herself, a dark box would be bad. But she's in like the bed of like a minivan, and then there's a bunch of other puppies that are in there in different crates, and they're all kind of stacked together, and you can see they're all kind of keeping each other company. So it's not, that's sort of the biggest fear is that it's going to just be a really freaky experience. really scare the dog. But I, you know, people I talked to about this said it wasn't, they didn't have concerns about that because they've done it before. And you have that same concern if you put them on a plane, you know, because you don't know what they're going to do. I've flown dogs a couple times. I've never had an issue, but it's definitely that thought's always in your head. So you never know where you put them.
Just at the surface level, you would think that a pup in a van full of other dogs, I mean, that could help, right? Like you might still have the pup that gets anxiety or whatever, but if they're around other dogs and they got a person there letting them out, I mean, as opposed to an airplane.
Yeah, they stop and let them out. Yeah, and the only thing, the only benefit to the airline is it's over quicker.
Sure, yeah, it happens faster. Yeah. But, given the timing and everything, it's probably a good thing you went with this route because I would imagine the airlines probably aren't flying dogs just with how cold it is right
now. Yeah, I don't know what they're doing. Yeah, but that's definitely it can be too cold and it can be too hot. Those are like the two. So when I've had dogs flown out, they've come out in like April and May. That's like the little window. But yeah, I think now it's too. I think a lot of times they put the dogs in the hold. They don't put them up on, you know, they're not up in the cabin.
Right.
So yeah, it can be a little too. I imagine now it can be a little too cold in that hold. But
Well, it's an interesting. I had heard a mention of it, and I don't know if it was somebody getting a pup or I'd heard of a similar service. And now that you mention it, it's something unique. You know, people are definitely getting puppies from places that they don't live at, so it's a good idea. And I would imagine with the ease of connecting, you know, they can run this sort of small scaled business and take advantage of some of that.
Yeah.
Running dogs around, it's a neat option for people, I guess.
Yeah, it's a great option. Yeah, it was either that or I was going to have to drive to Oklahoma.
All right. Have you ever flown a dog?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Okay. And was it a nightmare? Or
no, it was super easy. It was super easy. But again, you have to have that window. And a lot of – so before – it's gotten harder to do, basically. The airlines have – because basically what happens is the airlines killed some dogs. And then they had a backlash because of it. And now they're much more restrictive about when they allow you to do it and how they allow you to do it and stuff like that, which is all good. But it's just like, that's like the weather restriction. Like they had dogs that it was too hot and the dogs would be sitting in the hold on the tarmac, the plane would get held up and it's hot and the dogs can get exhaustion and problems can like stuff like that. So that's why now they're really strict on the temperature issues. My dogs came from the Midwest. I'm sure if you flew them from like LA or something, that might not, I don't know if they'll allow that, but other than that, now there's a special, at least here in Boston, there's a special gate they come into. So you just drive over there, pick them up.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never had to do it. And certainly when I think about taking longer distance trips, it's in my head. Like, you know, I wouldn't want to fly a dog. I guess that would be my first choice. But
If I was going hunting somewhere, I wouldn't fly a dog. I wouldn't put one of my dogs on a plane.
Yeah.
I would want it to be driven. And that's why you know, this dog hauling thing. I used to have a friend that used to go out to Montana every fall, and he used to take like a dozen dogs with him.
Yeah.
And he would go out there for the whole month, and he would take my dog, and I would go out there and fly into Montana and meet him and hunt for a couple weeks and then come back. And then he'd bring my dog back. So, and that was always really cool because if I go someplace hunting, I want to hunt with my own dogs. I just,
for sure,
I don't want to have other dogs.
When you did that, were you flying your own guns too, or was he taking your guns too?
He would take my guns.
Okay.
But I've flown guns.
Yeah.
I've never had a problem. And what I do now, though, is I actually mail them out. So it's easier to mail guns.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And you can mail stuff to your – so if you – say you want to go to – if you you can mail guns to yourself. Without having
to mail it to like a UPS center or something.
Yeah, or you can mail it to someone's address, but address it to yourself. So you don't have to fill out it. There's no 4473 paperwork, at least on long guns. I don't know about pistols and stuff, but so I could like when I go out to South Dakota, I would mail my guns. I'd send them out by like FedEx ground. I'd put my name on it and put it in a case, and then I'd put it out. You know, I'd send it a week ahead of time. Just send it out there. It'd be there when I got there, and then on the return, I would just, you know, drop it off at the FedEx center, and they would bring it back. I've done that a lot. You know, that's an easy way to go, because dealing with it in the airport, it just takes a while, and
I'm sure that's gotten more and more difficult over the years.
Yeah, it's a pain in the butt. You have to go through a little separate check-in and they inspect it. In my experience, they inspect it. It's more just, I worry about the way the guns are handled. Not to say that, you know, when I put them in FedEx, I have the super heavy duty case. I mean, I could probably drive my pickup truck over it and it wouldn't bother it.
Yeah, you're not putting it in your carrying case and just crossing your fingers.
Yeah, yeah. I have this like massive case, and then it's not a really fancy gun. You know, but what's so, the thing that's the really weird, crazy thing is though, last time I flew guns, I flew into South Dakota and I flew out there for opening day. So I flew into Sioux Falls and, you know, there's tons of guys. Like, if you're on an airplane out of like Minneapolis, two thirds of the guys on the plane are all going hunting.
Right.
So everybody's got guns and everyone and gun cases, like the travel cases, all kind of look the same.
Sure.
So you start, yeah. You see him come off the escalator, the little escalator that comes out with all your luggage. All the cases look the same. And I actually grabbed a case, got out to my truck, looked at it, and I was like, whoops.
Oh boy.
This isn't my case. And I looked at the little tag on it and I was like, eh. So, what I actually did
say,
now
it
is.
It didn't say Purdy on it, did it?
No. It didn't. That's why I went back. I was like, wait a minute. It's none. So what I do now, the advice I give people is if you have one of those cases, like, wrap like orange tape around it or something. So then you see it coming off right away, because I knew if I did it, it happens all the time. I'm sure there's guys all the time, especially like in South Dakota, those guys going to lodges. They probably get to the lodge and they're like, they go to take the case out and they're like, this isn't my case.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Even with suitcases, sometimes, you know, you see one, is that mine?
Or yeah. They all look
the same.
Check
the tag, you know? Yeah.
So.
Has it been a while since you've taken an out of state trip? Have you just been kind of chasing grouse of New England recently?
Yeah. The last time I went out west was, I think it's 2012 was my last trip to South Dakota.
Okay.
And I don't really anticipate going back out there. I don't have anything against it. I mean, I know. So I hunted a lot in South Dakota from like 2000 to 2010. And when the hunting was really phenomenal. And I know it's dropped off a lot since then. And I don't know that I'd want to see it. It'd be kind of sad to see it, you know. But, and then the other thing is I just do a lot more grouse hunting. It's not that far away. For my kind of dogs, grouse and woodcock's a lot better. Pheasant's really tough. You know, pheasants are tough on pointers. You know, they're really more of a flushing, especially if you hunt them in shelter belts and that kind of cover. It's not cover that pheasants sit still in. So
it's, if you live near good populations of wild bird and you've got access to wild birds and land, it's hard to think about making a really long trip, you know?
Yeah, unless it's really great hunting. Yeah, I mean, that, when I used to go out to South Dakota, it was like nothing I'd ever seen, and I doubt it'll be like, I don't think that'll ever come back in my lifetime. But we used to see it, you know, it wasn't a big deal to see 1,000 pheasants a day.
Well,
they were just everywhere. They were, you know, you drive by property you couldn't hunt, like private land, and you'd look out and there'd be a couple hundred pheasants out, you know, pecking on the corn that had fallen down. They'd come out in the evenings and they were just everywhere. But I know that since then, a lot of that land, all the shelter belts got dug out so the farmers could, you know, farm more land and do stuff like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm guessing in my casual observance of sort of the CRP, like, I'm guessing there was more CRP back then.
There was a shitload more.
Yeah.
Like hundreds of thousands of acres.
We're in a state right now where we don't have as much as we did
at
that point.
I bet you there's probably at least a 500,000 acres more back then. And that's one of the reasons why it was so good. There was like this freakish occurrence that happened. And I think it had something to do, basically there was a ton of land that was put into CRP by farmers.
Yeah.
And that sort of all came together at the end of the 90s. And so there was just a freakish explosion. I think they had some great weather periods. And
sure.
So there were a lot of areas that in 2000 that had pheasants that in 1990 didn't have pheasants. Like the pheasants expanded much further west, closer to Pierre. So, because I have family that's out there and they, you know, talking to my brother,
yeah.
They didn't have pheasants when he was a kid, when they were growing up. like they weren't that common. And we used to go to his family's ranch out there, and there were tons of pheasants. They were everywhere. And that was all because of the way the land changed over. Things switched from – there was more farming and less ranching. And then what happened is this: one of the big things that changed everything was the ethanol boom. So once ethanol boomed, corn became more valuable. They dug up more land to put more corn in. They dug up – they took out shelter belts. They took out cattail, wet areas. They tiled that up to dry it up so they could farm more. So, and then they took the CRP out. So you have less good habitat, you have less birds.
Yeah, that's not good. I know it's a balance. There's a lot of factors that play on the landscape. And I hear more and more about the Farm Bill and CRP enrollment. And I was listening to something the other day with Ed Arnett from TRCP talking about the Farm Bill and how they need to get some more enrollment in CRP. But there's, again, it's not every decision gets made with upland birds in mind.
Yeah. Well, the thing is if the farmers aren't going to put it in CRP if they can make more money doing something else.
Right.
And that was why there was this boom, was because I think it was low wheat prices or something like that. And the farmers could make more money by putting it in CRP. It was easier. And now they can make it by actually harvesting. So they switched over. Anyway. Yeah. But talk to somebody who used to hunt in South Dakota and from like 2001 to 2010, and it was just amazing.
It's interesting how much you hear things like that, where it's not like you're talking about 50 years ago. You're talking about, 10, 20 years ago, and the changes that happen within a lifetime. And just think about, we're here right now, and we kind of know the last handful of years, and the next couple of years you can kind of predict, but 10 years from now, who the hell knows?
Yeah. Well, if it could change over. If there was huge CRP enrollment, 20 years from now, make you good. But the shelter belts aren't coming back in my lifetime. Those shelter belts take a long time to grow. But no, I mean, just like the switch that from 1990 to 2015, or 2010, there was areas, like I said, there were very few pheasants, and then they were overrun with pheasants.
Yeah.
So it could change back. I mean, if people were more conservation minded and they switched stuff over,
Yeah.
But, some of the stuff though, when they tile stuff up to get rid of low wet areas, I don't know that you can do much about that though.
You don't just flip a switch there.
Yeah. I don't think you just, I don't know. I don't know if you have to go in and grind that up or. Anyway,
I would not know.
Yeah. Anyway, so I just moved on, who wants to be going around going, oh, you should have seen it when I saw it. It was incredible. And the biggest thing was to sort of, I made sure I spent a lot of time out there because I figured it wasn't going to last forever.
So. Yeah. Well, what's going on in the world of guns, Greg? What can you tell me about?
So the biggest thing, I was actually just getting ready to put a post up on my blog, dogsanddoubles.com about sort of the prices have started to come back a little on a lot of stuff.
Coming down.
They were coming down, and they've actually turned. The gun market itself is really hot right now.
Okay.
And stuff that like a year ago was difficult to sell. So like 12-gauge British box locks and 12-gauge American, like a 12-gauge Parker and stuff like that. Those prices have stabilized and they're starting to come up a little. There's demand out there for that stuff.
So you say come back, you mean in the way that I don't want them to
I mean, the thing is they're not where they were. It's not where they were 10 years ago. And I don't think you're going to see that again for a while. That demand that we had 10 years ago, we had from 2000 to 2010, you had all these baby boomer guys who'd always wanted to have a Parker or something.
Yeah.
And they poured into the market. You had a lot of new interest from Double Gun Journal. All that stuff came together. And there was and prices shot up. I don't think that's going to come back, at least not for a while. But what you are seeing is that stuff that you couldn't get rid of last year for $1,000, you can sell for $1,200 now. Now, maybe it was worth $2,000 at the peak, but it's starting to pick up and get back in there. And I know there's a lot of older guys who have collections of guns. And they've been sitting on the sidelines because they basically don't want to take the hit. They don't want to realize, have to accept the fact that
correct
their stuff wasn't or isn't worth what it was. Well, there's a little bit of hope, you know, they can make more money now. And I think you're getting to a point where a lot of stuff, it's a good time to sell, because the prices are firming up. I don't know how much firmer they'll get, you know, it's like trying to time the stock market, but at least you can get stuff sold and you can move it. And there seems to be more interest just in general in like side-by-sides and stuff. You know, we talked about this, about how, you know, the Italian companies are introducing new makers are coming on with new side-by-sides. And so there's definitely more interest in the new stuff, and that always means there's more interest in the vintage stuff.
Yeah, there's I know that is something we talked about previously on here, talking about vintage guns and an aging group of folks that have big collections that would someday find their way back to the market, or at least you can kind of anticipate that, whether or not that's happening right now. But you're saying that if folks were wanting to sell, now might not.
Yeah, and now's a good time to consider doing it, because I don't know how long this will continue. But
do you go through stretches of, because I guess, you know, I obviously understand you have a passion for these guns, and do you consider yourself a collector?
Not really, no.
Okay.
Because I don't have, like, so guys who are collectors, to me, so I use the stuff I use most of the stuff I get.
Yeah.
And I don't have a real, I guess I don't have a real focus on anyone. You know, so I'm not like a Parker collector. And there's guys who collect Parkers.
Yeah.
They want to get one example, one like 12-gauge example of every grade. You know, and I don't care. I don't, you know, I'm not interested in accumulating all of them. I just find stuff that I think's nice, and if I see it and the price is good, I'll buy it. I mean, I used to be more of like an accumulator, and I've always been more just kind of interested in them. So I would buy them just to check them out and see what they're all about and then get rid of them. I've never had the liquidity to just pile the things up.
Right.
You know, I've always had one that had to fund the next one.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And my interest in them is also in using them, like I said. Like, I know people who don't shoot and they have gun collections. They just like guns and like collecting.
Yeah, and that's what I was curious. And I guess I probably would have guessed that you were not really an accumulator. You were more kind of chasing down things that interested you and wanting to see what they're all about, use them. I feel like that's kind of where I find myself. And as I've dove deeper into it, I mean, just the history that gets tied into gun making, and I mean, that's intriguing to me, and the craftsmanship and the quality and all the different varieties. And I mean, I guess if I needed something else to spend my time on, this is it. Shotguns are, it's a big rabbit hole to go down.
It's a huge rabbit hole. There's tons of stuff to learn and stuff to see. And I know that, I think the more you learn and the more you see, the more, the pickier you get and the more, sort of discerning you get about what you like. Mm-hmm. And that's also been for me. And like, I went through like a lot of guys, like I started out with like Fox Sterlingworths and Parkers and LC Smiths. And you begin to look at, you know, as you see more stuff, you appreciate different things and you like different things. And
I would say that's really, since the last time that you and I spoke at that time, a couple of years ago, I had recently got my first Fox Sterlingworth, and yeah, I like that gun. I actually don't carry it much anymore because I don't shoot it that well.
Because it's got too much drop in the stock.
Something we talked about. Yeah, we talked about that.
That's
on
right. That's
episode.
What everybody learns once they buy one.
Right. Yep. And now I was kind of infatuated with that gun and the history of the Fox Company, and now I've sort of taken a step back and I've realized like there's just so much else out there that I'd like to put my hands on some of these other guns and shoot some of this other stuff. And, you know, I know better what I shoot better as for a gun, so that helps. And that's kind of, it's got me looking across the pond a little bit to English guns, which I think is something that we haven't really talked about, and I kind of want to talk about that. I've been reading a lot lately about the English gun making and sort of everything that happened at the turn of the 19th century. And really, I mean, this won't be news to folks that have been collecting or buying guns for a long time, but just fascinating how that all came together, the breech loading break action double gun at the end of the 1800s. Like, they essentially perfected that gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like, have you ever come up with or heard anybody make an analogy, like, what other industry did they literally perfect the thing 150
right,
years ago
right.
or whatever. And like, there's no, I mean, the innovation that happens in the gun world today is not really related to like, it's just like some of it's gimmicky. And I wouldn't say that entirely, because like our interview with Cesar Guarini, I think is, that's an example of like really excellent innovation in gun making. But
yeah, it's not, they're not huge steps forward though.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
not like the difference between a hammer gun and a hammerless gun. You know, like hammerless,
or like a computer in 1980 versus a computer today.
Yeah,
you know?
It's just like, I guess kind of like combustion engines haven't really. I don't know how much different a Ford. I mean, they're obviously you know, fuel injection and stuff, but overall, combustion engines are still kind of very similar.
Yeah.
But
but
definitely side by sides. I mean, like a hammerless box lock side by side or side lock side by side. I mean, Purdy is building the same gun today that they were building in 1900. You know, it's the same gun. Some of the techniques that he used to make it, they made some little tweaks to probably make them a little quicker to make. But other than that, it really is the same gun. Same thing with Boss. The brand new Boss OU that you buy today is essentially the same gun that they were making in 1920. So yeah, I mean, they did pretty much perfect it, and that's part of the problem. You got to come up with something new to sell people.
What else do you do? Yeah,
that's right. You have to keep inventing something new to get them in the door. So you come out with 25-inch barrels, or you come out with 34-inch barrels, or
right. I just was reading I'm reading currently the book by Michael McIntosh, Best Guns.
Yeah,
and which is a really good you probably read that book 10 years ago, Greg, but it takes you around the world as far as gun making goes. And it starts out in America, and it kind of hits the Fox, Parker, Ithaca, Lefevre, all those stories, which is very cool for American guns. And then now I'm in the UK section reading about all the British gun makers. And it's quite fascinating how that story really came together.
Yeah. Yeah. And all those Michael McIntosh books are awesome. He's probably my favorite overall gun writer. And it's a great story. Yeah, I mean, it's all kind of a lot of the American guns were. I always thought that a lot of the American guns were based on British designs. They were basically trying to find their way around patents. They didn't want to infringe on patents, so they kind of came up with their own spin on things, especially like a Fox and the Parker. And then Ithaca was trying to come up with a real inexpensive way to make guns, and all the different ways people approached it, the difference between the audience for American guns is a lot different than the audience for British guns, and how that affected the end product. Like you say, you can go down a huge rabbit hole on this, and there's tons to learn. And this is just like, and that's just shotguns, and there's double rifles.
All
that stuff is a whole nother world.
I got to draw the line somewhere, Greg.
Yeah. And you have so much time you can dedicate to this stuff.
I know in the past we ran circles around kind of the Fox guns, and we probably talked a little bit about Parkers, but how much have you shot, handled the Ithacas, the Lefevres, the LC Smiths?
I've had a bunch of LC Smiths. Had Ithacas. I've had them all, basically. I've shot them all. As far as, I think my favorites overall, my favorite is, Lefevres are my favorite. And Lefevres, what I mean say Lefevres, I mean what are called Syracuse Lefevres. There's different incarnations of Lefevre.
Yeah.
And the ones I'm interested in, I think they were made from like 1890 to about 1917, like right around in there.
There's a lot of partnerships back then, like partnerships that came together in the gunmaking world and then went separate ways. And I think Lefevre was one of them, where it was Dan Lefevre, and then he was working with somebody, and then they would part ways, and then you'd have somebody over here advertising a Lefevre gun, and then somebody over here advertising it a little bit different way. So,
Yeah, he had a lot of partnerships. Like starting out, there was different groups of guys came together to build the guns, and then he started his own company, and then somehow lost control of it, and he went off and started another company. And like LC Smith, the guys that started LC Smith. I guess Lyman Cornelius Smith, I'm getting his guy's name. I think he started it in Syracuse or something. That company went through some different iterations, but the family that started that sold the business off and went off to found the LC Smith typewriter. And that's how they got filthy rich. Because basically they were looking at guns and like, this is a waste of time. We can make more money doing something else. So they sold it off, and then they founded L.C. Smith. I think L.C. Smith Corona or something. Anyway, they invented basically some of the first useful typewriters, and they got filthy rich off that. But L.C. Smith went through different incarnations too. They sold the company to the Hunter Brothers or something in 1913, changed the guns a little bit. I think Ithaca was owned by the same people for a long time, the same organization, but they came up with a lot of different models.
Yeah, there was iterations in
there were like Flues, and there was the NID. I've owned Flues, and I've owned the NIDs. I haven't owned – there's some other weird ones out there. But the best ones are the NIDs. Those are the ones – I think they started making them in like 1920s or so. They start at 425,000 on the serial numbers. But Ithaca made tons of guns. I mean, they're probably the most prolific of all the American gun makers, side-by-side makers. But the NIDs are the latest ones. And they're good guns. You know, they're like F-150 pickup trucks. They're in like old school F-150s, not those new fancy platinum ones. They're like the old ones. They're like work guns, you know? And they used to be pretty cheap. Not so that not so much anymore, but so, and the L.C. Smiths are cool. I don't think if I were to rank them, I like Parkers and Lefevers probably up near the top. I put Fox in the middle, and then L.C. Smiths and Ithacas would come in near the bottom. So,
well, as soon as you start ranking them, you're gonna piss somebody off.
yeah, no, that's true. I've had them all. I shot them.
They've all,
I've
got their collector clubs, and yeah.
But they're all cool in their own ways, aren't they?
Right. I guess that would be my takeaway. It's part of the story of shotguns in America. And again, I enjoy reading about the history. I know that's not for everybody, but
yeah.
The other one I did want to ask you about was the Winchester Model 21, because that's a unique story.
Yeah,
and those guns are, as far as I understand, they're incredibly well built, super strong guns. They demand a really high price relative to some other stuff you see on the market.
Yeah, so I don't know how well made they are, really. Okay. I think that's a little bit of a myth. I don't think they're any superior. I don't think they're superior to a Parker or anything like that. And the idea, the way their barrels are put together, are superior. I don't think there's any truth in that. I think there's a lot of myth and misinformation around that. The guns themselves, they're fine. They're good guns. They work, but I don't know if they're superior in any way. I never thought they were very attractive.
That's the interesting thing about them. They're pretty pedestrian looking.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought they're kind of ugly. They're heavy, you know. You're right. They're expensive. The only ones I ever really liked were the real early 12 gauges with the double triggers and the funky stocks on them.
They eventually switched to single triggers, I think.
Yeah, mainly. A lot of single triggers. They just get more refined, and then they get more, you know, and they start doing a lot of different grades, and then they have the Grand Americans, and the Grand Americans are like the pimped-out Cadillac version. They're guys who like those, and I know people that tell me that, like those, the big ones, too, the big heavy ones with like the vent ribs and the big pistol grips, and they've got the funky engraving, checkering on them. People swear that they shoot those guns phenomenally well. I know people who have a lot of British guns and are really crazy about British guns. And the guns they shoot the best is, like, I know a guy has a Model 21 Trap or something, but it's one of those big, heavy 21s that it's got like the beaver, it's got all the crap on it. It's the exact opposite of a British gun, but the Model 21 is the gun he shoots the best. He doesn't want to admit it. Like, he's horrified that that's true, but that's the case. So. It's not a gun that I would ever, I think I had one of those 12 gauges, I had an early one with double triggers. And it was,
so you did own one.
It was fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't anything, it wasn't all it was hyped up to be. So, at least for me.
Interesting. Well, I've never had one. I know a couple people that I think have had them in the family, kind of passed down. The thing that always jumps out at me is when I see one for sale, they seem to be very highly priced.
They do. I don't know that they're that rare, really. I wouldn't be surprised if there was 50,000 of those built. But for whatever reason, they have, I think maybe because they were made later, you know, they used probably more modern
steels. They continued making them. Yeah,
they made them for a long time. They started, I don't think they started making them until like the 30s or something.
Yeah. There's a story, I want to say the guy's name is, I'm going to mess this up, but it's Olin. He invented the Western ammunition and eventually came together with Winchester. And I'm reading all this stuff. It's fresh in my mind, but it all runs together because McIntosh, I mean, he goes down. I mean, he tells you why, like, there was X number of guns produced and what the factors were going on, but I just have too much stuff rolling around in my head. But I do know that that guy, he kept the Winchester Model 21 alive, like, against all odds, like, through time, and that's why there are, I think, a number of them made.
Yeah, yeah, I think he believed in them, and I think he just wanted, I think it was probably kind of a brand thing that he had, an idea for Winchester. I think they probably made more money on other stuff, and he just wanted to keep it going so that they had a side-by-side shotgun. And by the time he was building that, that was the only high-quality side-by-side. I mean, after World War II, that was pretty much it. That was being made in America. You know, there was like the Fox Model B, which was a low-quality gun. You know, there were some Stevens being made, but that was the only high-quality American gun that you could order. And I think that's part of, you know, there's always a lot of American mystique around this stuff, you know, attracts people to them. So.
Well, here we are talking about American guns again.
Yeah.
I think we maybe talked about this on a previous episode, but I keep circling back to this. For folks that don't know, there's this discrepancy in that a lot of American guns were made with, I'd say, maybe shorter length of pull, but definitely more drop, more drop at heel in the stocks, as opposed to their overseas counterparts. And really, the English guns, you'll see drop in some of the Continental stuff, from the Germans and the Belgians, but less so in the English gun. Have you ever heard? I've heard a bunch of like sort of pet theories about we're bigger now, or we shoot with our heads higher today. Like, have you ever heard a really good definitive explanation as to why that is, Greg?
So I've never heard a good explanation, but my theory is that Americans tended to hold their heads up when they shot. Because if you take one of those, so if you take a gun with a lot of drop and you bring your cheek hard down to the comb, you'd only see the back of the gun.
You're looking at the back of the action.
You can't see. And I think what was going on is a lot of Americans back then, when they shot, they weren't so first of all, they weren't learning to shoot like a lot of guys learn to shoot now. Like, they weren't going to they weren't going out and shooting sporting clays, right?
Yeah.
Because when you shoot sporting clays, you know, you're mounting that gun and you're bringing your cheek down hard so you can get consistent mounts and you're doing stuff like that.
Especially if you're pre-mounting, which I won't recommend on the Upland podcast, but
but if you learn to shoot that way, that's what you're going to do. And if you want to shoot more accurately, it's a good thing to do. I mean, that's just
consistency.
Yeah, you want the consistent mount. I don't think those early American shooters were learning to shoot with their heads down hard on the combs. And I think the conditions they were shooting in, shooting a lot of wild game, and they were flushing birds up. In those situations, you want to have your head up and you want to be able to see what's going on. Yeah. I think that's always been my theory. And I also think there was just a lot more birds. So if you're taking a lot more shots over the course of the day so say those guns are a little less accurate, but you're making a lot more shots, you're still killing a lot of birds. So, and I think in the UK, the shooting was much more formal there. And, you know, if you were someone
driven
who was going
shoots,
like shooting driven birds, you were wealthy.
Yep.
And you were most likely taught to shoot by someone. And they were bringing their heads down. Driven game is, you know, driven shooting is a lot more like target shooting. You know, the birds are high. But basically, again, they were bringing their heads down. So they had the higher combs in order to make those guns work for them in those situations. That's always been my theory. I don't know anything about it. I saw an article once about, I have an article about a guy who recommended extreme drops in the stock. But he also recommended really high combs. So if you can imagine, like, the stock, it was almost like a dog leg stock. Like, so they just like drop off the ass end from the comb.
So you got a steeper angle, so it starts up high, but then it drops
so it
down
just drops
to
right off.
Yeah.
And the reason he advocated for that was he wanted you to be able to, he didn't like the idea of scrunching down, like crawling a comb, crawling a stock, like you'll see target shooters do.
Yep.
He wanted you to be able to hold your head up high. So when you mounted the gun, you should be able to hold your head up high and see what's going on. you pull the gun up and the comb hits your cheek. In order for that to happen, the comb has got to be really high because the gun itself has to be able to mount down in your shoulder.
Right.
So anyway, this guy in the article, he has these Parkers and he has them mounted that way and they look like dog legs.
Like he's got them restocked.
Yeah, he had them restocked so that they would be. So, and he shows them mounting them. And it's, you know, if you think about it, have you ever seen a gun with a Monte Carlo stock?
Yep.
That's what a Monte Carlo stock does. Yeah. So Monte Carlo stock, it drops the butt of the stock down onto your shoulder while keeping the comb really high so that it's a much more natural mount. You don't have to drop your head down. So the guy was onto something. They're just ugly as shit. And so.
Yeah, they definitely don't have the sleek lined, traditional looking gun. Yeah. Yeah.
And W.C. Scott used to make pigeon guns and target guns with Monte Carlo stocks, but they were never super popular. I've seen some Parkers with them.
Interesting stuff. And again, it's a rabbit hole all in itself. Many folks will grab a gun off the rack and shoot it and be
happy with it. I can shoot guns with dropping them if I practice a little.
Yeah.
And that's probably more because I didn't learn to shoot at a target range and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't have that habit of wanting to get my head down and really lock it on the stock.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So when it comes to English guns, walk me through a little bit about the difference between, say, like guns that were made in London and then guns that were made in Birmingham. Because you actually wrote about this a little bit in an article you wrote on the ProjectUpland.com website about how the box lock kind of came to be. Mm-hmm. And you talked about sort of what was going on in London and Birmingham, which is essentially 100 miles away kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So Wesley Richards was in Birmingham. So Birmingham is a city that is northwest of London. I know you're right. It's like 120 miles.
Yeah.
And London is like, back then, London was the center of the world. London was the shit. And if you were really rich, you had a house in London. But that was the center of the world, center of sophistication in a lot of ways. Birmingham was more like, like the working town. It wasn't nearly as polished. It wasn't as fancy. And Wesley Richards was up in Birmingham, and there are a lot of gun makers in Birmingham. And Wesley Richards invented what we call the box lock shotgun. And it was one of the first really successful hammerless designs. And it was it's one of the most successful hammerless shotgun designs of all time, and it's still used today. It's probably the most copied design of all time.
And when you say hammerless, you're referring to the fact that the guns used to have hammers on the outside
Correct.
Of the gun.
Right. It still has hammers, but they're not exposed.
All that stuff's going inside.
Yeah. So that was the big change that they made, like starting in the 1870s, late 1860s. I'm sorry, like the 1880s. They took those hammers that were exposed and they moved them inside the guns.
Yeah.
And different people were trying to come up with different patents for how to do that. And Wesley Richards came up with one of the first successful patents, something that was it was easy to build, it worked, and people responded to it by buying it. But he was in Birmingham, so his guns were being made in Birmingham. People and because of that, there was a stigma to them. Birmingham wasn't associated with producing the finest quality goods, and it also wasn't where the big money was. And that was all in London, because that was, Buckingham Palace is in London, the Queen's there. So everyone that sort of traveled in that world was around there. The West End of London, that area was associated with having sort of the premier quality goods. And the gun makers there, by association, were considered to be the best gun makers in the world. And the designs they came up with, so Purdy came up with a design for a hammerless gun. But theirs is a side lock. It's a different design. Yeah. Holland and Holland came up with one. Boss came up with one. Those designs are different. They're probably, the designs themselves are more complicated. But I don't know that they're any better than a Wesley Richards box lock. But because of the stigma of Birmingham versus London, the London guns were more prestigious in their day, and they're still more prestigious. So And that was, when I wrote in that article, that was, it was basically snobbishness, that,
yeah.
And it was, that was a very snobbish time. I mean, if you were from a certain background and you shot at certain places, you wouldn't show up with box locks. You wouldn't be invited back because a gentleman didn't shoot box locks. You shot side locks. And then if you were from certain backgrounds, you shot Purdy's or you shot, you know, blah, 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 blah. But that's the way the people were. And, so that was one of the big reasons why Wesley Richards were popular over here. They came over here to try to find a bigger market because they couldn't sell as much in the UK. So okay. At least their shotguns. So.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to ask you is, of course, any kind of gun design, you know, there's a million examples of each one. There's a million box locks. There's a million side locks. Oh, can you hear that?
Is it on my end?
No, it's on my end. There's a blender going on over here. Hang on one second. All right, anyways, back to box locks and side locks. I wanted your take on, I know there's some, I think the idea behind the side lock is it's kind of like has like the sleekest lines and, or at least that's, you know, how it was kind of set up where it's this fine handling, sleek line gun. Mm-hmm. Today we have box locks that I think kind of reach some of that, but in your experience handling either, like, do you find a huge difference in, like, a perfectly balanced side lock versus a box lock?
No, I don't think there's any. I don't notice a difference. The thing is, there's, as long as the guns were both made to the same levels of quality, there's not much of a difference, you know?
Yeah.
But box locks were made, I think box locks were definitely less expensive to build. I think they were.
Right.
And they tended to have been built in a wider range of grades. So like there's really inexpensive box locks out there that don't compare to a nice side lock.
Right. Right.
Whereas companies like, companies like Purdy and Boss tended to focus most of their energy on making really fine guns.
Right.
A really nice Greener, a really nice Wesley Richards, they handle great. I don't notice a difference. I mean, they're sure there's guys out there who are, you know, probably sensitive enough to it or shoot enough that can probably tell you there's a difference, but yeah. I think a lot of it's psychological.
Yeah, and there's so much variety, and it's hard to make an apples-to-apples comparison. And today, you know, what you see in a side-by-side at, like, say, an entry-level market side-by-side, you know, it's going to be a box lock, and that's just the way that it is because they're, I mean, the designs and the patents that were developed 100-some-odd years ago, they're still kind of like that's the way to build the gun, and now we have CNC machining, and we got processes where we can build those guns at economical prices, and that's what we see.
Yeah, I think most of the some of those Italian guns that are being made now, those Italian side by sides, I don't think those are box locks. I mean, they look like box locks, but I think they're trigger plate guns.
Really?
Yeah. So I think they're basically the same design that the over and unders, a lot of the Italian over and unders use. And they've just modified it for a side by side, but the lock work sits on the trigger plate, so it's not technically. It looks like a box lock, but it's not really a box lock. But you know, AYAs, they make a box lock. All those other, and those are just Anson and Dealey box locks. Wesley Richards is still out there building guns. They're still, you know, making box locks. So
well, we won't dive into trigger plate.
Yeah,
guns
no,
today,
just
but
down another hole.
But I will say that you've got an article upcoming in a future issue of the magazine that's going to talk about probably the most, would you say, the most famous trigger plate gun?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good segue.
Yeah.
Yes, Dixon's.
Give us a sneak peek on that one.
Yeah, so it's all about, so I wrote an article for upcoming issue of Project Upland, which is about the history of John Dixon and Son, this famous Scottish gunmaker. And yep. They're famous for a gun called the Round Action, which is a trigger plate design, a trigger plate side by side. I think it's the only, it was the only mass produced, it was the only British trigger plate gun that was made in any real numbers. And it was handmade. All Round Action Dixons are best quality guns. There were a few other people that made kind of trigger plate guns in the UK, but they didn't make them didn't make a lot of them. They're pretty unusual. But the Dixons were made in Edinburgh. I think they started making them in like 1880, and they still make them today. They're kind of quirky guns. And they have a real following. You know, people are crazy about them. And they really like them. But they're
not a lot of them made, and it's a really neat story for somebody that's into double guns and side-by-sides. It definitely is intriguing, but the unfortunate thing is they're like essentially out of reach for
they're pretty pricey. I mean, a good
you have
one
to really want one.
I mean, even a good used one's, you know, at least $8,000. And I think brand new, I think if you wanted to order one nowadays, I don't know, they're like, I don't know, $60,000 or something, say like that. Which is a ridiculous sum of money. But as far as British guns, brand new British guns go, that's actually on the, that's on the less expensive side. But they're fantastic guns. They're totally different than a box lock. They're totally different than a side lock. You know, they're like a platypus. They're it's its own thing. It's unique. It's unusual. It's sort of very much this quirky design that kind of originated in Scotland. They borrowed some ideas from Germany. But it created a gun that was very popular within, basically within, like, the guy that owns Dixon now told me. So they built 2,000 round actions. Basically, they built maybe 2,200 to date they've made. And something like 70% of those guns were sold to people that lived within, like, 150 miles of Edinburgh. So they had, amongst the, like, wealthy people that lived up there, they had a real devout following. And that's the way it was. You know, it's only been in the last like 10, 15 years that it become really popular with Americans. And then everybody saw that video on YouTube with a guy shooting it. Now everybody's crazy about it.
That just came out recently. And oddly, like, I haven't gone looking for this, but I've had a number of people mention that.
Yeah, I've had a bunch of people. And they all want a Dixon now.
And coincidentally, you're writing this article about it, you know. I mean, it's awesome. It's crazy. The value of them is going to skyrocket now. But the way that it in the video, it's Simon Reinhold, he talks about it, and he talks about how they were designed to shoot red grouse in over there, but he talks about it like a game gun, and it got a lot of people excited.
and they're worth all the attention. They're beautifully made guns, and they were just, like I said, because there so many of them were sold near the maker, they never got the notoriety that like guns like Purdy's. I think Dixon did a little bit to try to sell them over here in the U.S., but for a long time, I mean, back in 2000, I worked in a gun shop. We had one in there, and no one knew what the hell the thing was. Nobody cared. Yeah. No one, like, you'd show it to them, and they just, you know, it was like you put rotting fish in front of them. They wanted nothing to do with that thing, even though it was a beautiful gun. But now there's a lot more information out there, and people are, you know, gradually become more excited about them. And in that video, people are definitely, I've had like four or five guys in the last, you know, since that video come out, email me asking me if I knew anything about those guns. It's like, you saw that video.
That's funny. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I'll put that video in the show.
Yeah, you got to put it in.
It's cool, actually. And people, if they're interested, they should check it out. But, well, from that way far end of the spectrum of a gun that many of us will probably never own, is there anything on the other end of the spectrum that is getting you excited at the moment? Something new? Anything?
So I think the most interesting thing going on right now in gun making to me is how much quality you can buy. And I don't want to say how little money, but basically quality has never been more affordable. And so you've got gun makers like Guarini. You've got some of the other Italian makers who are building really high quality guns for prices that aren't insane, you know?
Yeah.
And Guarini's, you know, some of those Guarini over and unders, quality wise, they're not that far from a London, you know, quality gun.
I mean, you could legitimately buy a Guarini and expect that thing to last your lifetime.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you can get it will, and you can get it serviced. They're beautifully made. So you can spend $10,000 on a Guarini and get a fabulous gun. You can spend less on a Beretta, and they're fabulous guns. Those new, like those Rizzini side-by-sides that are out there now, those Fab Arm side-by-sides, they're all really well-made guns. So I think the thing is quality, a lot of quality is now more affordable than ever. Even those Dickinson things out of Turkey, those are still, for the, like, if a guy just wants to bird hunt, that's a great gun. And it's brand new, It has modern dimensions, modern steel. You can probably put steel through all of them, so you don't have those concerns. They're replaceable if you, you know, if one of them gets wrecked in shipping. There's a tremendous amount of advantages. There's differences, you know, those guns aren't, I haven't come across one that is on par with a top British gun, but you shouldn't expect it to be.
They're not expected to be, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, if they can get you 70% of the way there, if I was one of those British gun makers, my biggest concern would be companies like Guarini. Because Guarini can just, I mean, if they can do that for 10,000, what could they do for 20,000? You know?
Right.
I don't know. They could probably do something that's on par with a Purdy over and under, you know, that costs $75,000. So that's what I think. And those new, what are those new RFN things? I saw those. I was checking out the website. I think that's that whole movement of guys being able to get a really nice new gun and not have to spend a fortune, especially side-by-sides, because the side-by-side market was, you've been able to get good OUs. But side-by-sides now, you know.
Yeah, the selection there was way, way different than, like you said, you could go buy a Beretta, you could go buy a Guarini, but the side-by-side market was a different story.
Yeah, it was pretty dead. And then the RBLs came out, and then like those Dickinsons, Smith & Wesson, those kind of things started coming out.
Yep, I had one of those.
Yeah, I mean, and that was like the wave of, you know, the quality is keeps improving. In a lot of ways, the prices are still very fair. You know, and like I said in that article, that I was talking to a guy, and he said their company would never make side-by-sides because side-by-sides were dead.
Dead, yeah.
And that was 2 years ago, and now they just came out with a side-by-side. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Good news for side-by-side fans.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a lot of interest. There's more interest in them now than ever before.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's good to see. So.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, it was great to catch up with you. This will not be the last time we have you on the podcast. I appreciate it. Where can folks go? Are you still putting out weekly Good Gun Alerts?
Oh, yeah. I still put out once a week on my blog. I put out Good Gun Alerts on Sundays. I put those up on my blog. I post other stuff during the week. So dogsanddoubles.com. I'm on Instagram at dogsanddoubles. I put up pictures. I'm going to be doing more once I get the new dog. I got to do more dogs. Most of my stuff is doubles.
Do more dogs. Heavy on the doubles lately.
Yeah. So, they're still going out. Go to dogsanddoubles.com and follow me on Instagram. I need more followers. I want to get to the big leagues like Project Upland.
Yeah. Well, I think people know when they need your expertise, they know how to find you.
Yeah. And they can always reach out to me. If you want to talk about buying stuff, you want to talk about the best ways to sell stuff.
Yeah.
I get emails from guys all the time and do what I can to help them.
Cool. Well, I appreciate your time, Greg, and thanks for dropping some knowledge on me and the Project Upland listeners.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
All right.
See you later, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning into the Project Upland podcast. That does it for this episode of the show. A quick reminder that the Project Upland podcast is brought to you by OnX Hunt, Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food, CZ USA, Electronic Shooters Protection, Sage & Breaker, and Dakota 283. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Project Upland podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.